No?
Okay.
This is an interview with Steve Johnson. It's January 22nd, 2008. We're in the studio on WILL AM/FM TV in Urbana, Illinois. I'm Nancy Rotzel, and I'm going to be doing the interview. Steve, where were you when World War broke out, when Pearl Harbor started? Would you tell me a little bit about that, and then maybe give me something about your early life?
Sure. I was living on the south side of Chicago at 7213 South Bennett Avenue, to be exact. And I was, let's see, this is 1941, so I was 16 years old. And the news that came about Pearl Harbor was after we got home from church that Sunday. We had been going to a Lutheran church also on the south side of Chicago, and the world kind of stopped at that point when those that news came out, because everybody knew what that was going to be, what was going to happen after that. So I'll get a little more into that later, but as to my background, right now I'm 82 years old. I was born in Sweden, a little town called Åmål, in 1925, and we made a trip to Åmål last summer, and it was described as being the second most beautiful town in the world, with populations of less than 100,000. I didn't find out what the first one was, but anyhow, it's about 100 miles from Stockholm, and I came to the United States in 1928 with my mother, who was 24 at the time, and my brother, who was 2 years older, he was five, and I had my third birthday on the boat coming over. My dad came to Chicago, where he had come 3 years earlier, and he saved enough money to get transportation costs for us, the rest of his family, to come at that point. And we wound up on the south side of Chicago, and so my brother and I were both foreign born, and after Pearl Harbor, my brother enlisted in the Marines at the age of 19, and he was shipped out to Camp Pendleton in California. He was assigned to a casual platoon because he had enlisted, and they hadn't confirmed his citizenship status, so they wanted to be sure he wasn't a spy or an agent, a secret agent or whatever. So the folks had to send out to California my dad's original certificate of citizenship for him to be accepted and as a Marine. So he wound up in the 4th Marine Division, and he went on to places like Saipan and Tinian and Kwajalein and Eniwetok and finally Iwo Jima. So he went all through the war and came home safely. So my mom and dad were able to put up these window hangers with two sons in the service. The white ones were, I got them backwards. No, I don't, that's right. The blue ones when we were both in the service, and the silver ones were because we were both overseas. So let's see. Just a brief thing about my background. I went to schools on the south side of Chicago. I was 8 years at Bryn Mawr Elementary School, 2 years at Hyde Park High School, and two of my fellow students at Hyde Park were Steve Allen and Mel Torme. Not that we were buddies, but they were there. And then I went on to 2 years at South Shore High School, which is on the South Side. It was a brand new school, and I was in that area, so I got transferred from Hyde Park to South Shore. Then I spent a year at Wilson Junior College. On May 6, 1943, I turned 18. And on June 5th, I was classified 1A. And on June 30th, I was inducted into the Army. Pretty fast entry. This is a picture of the that they took at the Selective Service Center, if I can find it. Yeah, I should have dug it out closer. Yeah. Well, I can't find it real fast, so. Does this happen often? Okay, so I reported for active duty on July 14th, 1943, at Camp Grant in Rockford, Illinois. And after 12 days there, I left by train for Fort Ord, California, and arrived there on July 31st.
And what rank were you?
I was definitely a buck private, no rank, 18 years old, just first time I'd been away from home that far in my life.
Other than Sweden?
Other than Sweden, right, yep. So at Fort Ord, we took our basic training there, and we were told that it would be about 12 weeks, and it turned out to be more than that, and we found out later that the reason was that one of the troop transports that was going to take us overseas was sunk by the Germans. So we didn't actually leave the States until January 5th, 1944. As far as the at Fort Ord, we had the usual basic training of we did a lot of calisthenics, a lot of training on various munitions, and we did bivouacs, we did that sort of thing. Not too much unusual there. But on the 5th of January, we boarded a Dutch liner called the New Amsterdam, N-I-E-U, it was spelled. And we had about 10,000 troops on that ship that normally held like 2,000 cruise ship customers. And we were quartered in the theater of the ship, 7 bunks high. So you can imagine the close quarters that we had. We only got 2 meals a day because as soon as they finished one meal, they were ready to start the second one with 10,000 troops on board. I wondered whether I would get seasick because I hadn't been on that kind of a boat before. And when we left San Francisco Harbor and saw the Golden Gate diminishing in the rear view mirror, so to speak, the ship started swelling, and but I survived that, and I did not get sick. A lot of the guys did, and that was unpleasant. But we finally all made it to. We arrived in Auckland, New Zealand, and spent one day and one night there. We never got off the ship. Except I was reading a letter from one of my buddies where he said we all got off and were given an ice cream bar. I don't even remember that, but anyway, the stop in New Zealand was very brief. And it took, about 19 days for the entire trip from Frisco to New Zealand. And we were all under blackout orders, no lights on the ship at night, and we passed the time by playing cards, and they had things like boxing matches and not much else, but that sort of thing. So then from Auckland we went to Sydney, Australia, and we were there in Australia for about 3 weeks. Sort of an R&R situation before we went up into the islands. And I don't remember much about Australia except we were in Sydney, and there was an entertainment spot like a carnival or something of that sort that we visited, and there were girls, and the girls were young and attracted to the troops, and they had the accent. They were only 18, so we enjoyed the trip, the stay in Sydney. And then on February 10th of 1944, we got aboard the USS Etaman, E-T-A-M-I-N, and wound up in on the southern tip of New Guinea, a town called Milne Bay.
Where along the line did they decide what your job was going to be? Were you tested? How did they do that?
Well, we were told that when we were at Camp Grant, before we went to California, that we were told that they had selected those with the highest testing, what do they call it, not the IQ, but that equivalent, and that those were the boys that were being assigned to this outfit. So there weren't any. Now, I came into the outfit. My unit was the 3rd Engineer Special Brigade, the 543rd Engineer Boat and Shore Regiment, C Company, 2nd Boat Platoon. And most of these fellows had been down to Florida, boat training down there, and then also in a camp in Massachusetts. I forget the name of it. But so they had a great deal of the boat training that I missed because I came in on the late end. Periodically there would be promotions from private to PFC, and I don't know, it took me a while to get the first stripe. And then later on I got the second stripe with a T, technician fifth grade. That made me qualified to be an engineman on the boat. Which I might say a little bit about the boat. I was on a landing craft, 50 foot long, ramp loading. It was 14 feet wide, and it was propelled by two screws, propellers. They called them screws, and rudders, and. Let's see, what else about the boat? The boats were shipped to Milne Bay, New Guinea, where I was just saying we had arrived, and that was the point of assembly. They shipped the boats in units of about, I think there were 12 units to the full boat. There were three bulkheads on one side, three on the other, and then three on the well of the boat. And then, of course, the stern and the ramp, and these were all shipped broken down because these were 50 foot long. And then they were assembled in Milne Bay. It became a boat factory in effect. And as they were completed, the guys were assigned four to a boat. There was a coxswain, an engineman, and two seamen. So at one point they got up to, I think, where they were putting out like 150 of these boats per month for several months, until they reached the point where they had the amount that they needed. And then the men who had been in Carrabelle, Florida, and in Massachusetts, those were the veterans, and they were the first ones to get the higher grade stripes, and they would be T4s, technician fourth grade, and the T was to indicate that they didn't have line authority. They were not commandeering or supervising or ordering around the other troops. So then when we first arrived in New Guinea, we were in the jungles. There was nothing there. So we slept on cots for a while, with mosquito bars, mosquito nets over us, because they were vicious in that area. And then as they unloaded the boats in the packing crates, they used that lumber to build the floors, to build a deck for the tents that they put up eventually, and it took a while. And even farther down the road, they were able to generate electricity, and mm-hmm. So we had lights. At first, we had candles and flashlights, and so the nights were kind of long. But we had worked hard all day, and we slept pretty good. So.
Did you have any idea where you were going?
Nope, we had no idea. No, not even when we were in Australia. So when we were on the boat heading there, they finally told us. But and then they told us pretty much what we would be doing. And what we were doing in New Guinea was transporting supplies and troops to cities and towns farther up the peninsula, or the island, New Guinea. And anything from vehicles, or would be jeeps, small trucks, troops, supplies, food, munitions, all kinds of things. We were kind of a traveling trucker in that situation. And then we would, there were towns along the way like Oro Bay, O-R-O, which means gold in Spanish. And in my journal, I kept a logbook during the time we were overseas. And in the logbook, I spelled it O-R-A-L, because I thought that's what they were saying. And one of my buddies pointed out some years later, hey, that should be O-R-O. Okay. And then there was Finchhaven, Gazmata. There were some towns nobody ever heard of. And we would go from one end of the island to the other and back, picking up more stuff and bringing it on up the island. Some of the other places that were mentioned, Cape Ferguson, Kiwak, Itapi, Hollandia, Wack D, Angau, Lindenhaven. So there was a lot of, as I say, places nobody ever heard of. Then we went from there to New Britain Island, which was close. And did the same thing. As we were getting closer to the action, we would move along, and then we went to places like Maui Harbor, Sac-Sac River, Ablingi Island, Awab Point, Bertha Channel, Ring Ring, Siwat, Wallangau, Palelo, and Ajut, all kinds of strange towns where we delivered our stuff. During one of those trips, I contracted malaria, and we were I started shivering and shaking, and we were taking, they did not have quinine, which was the main antidote for malaria in those days. They had something called atabrine, which was a yellow pill, and you took, I don't know whether it was one with every meal or one a day, but it was pretty regular, and it actually made you look yellow after you took it for a long time, but in my case, it didn't help prevent it. So I was in the hospital at Oro Bay for recuperating for about 7 or 8 weeks. They dropped me off on the way down, and then the next time they came that way, they picked me up again. So I was out of commission there for a period of time. And then we went on to places like Wewak, Itapi. I mentioned some of those. Later in that year, 44, we went to an island called Biak in the Schouten Islands, S-C-H-O-U-T-E-N. They called it the Netherlands East Indies or the Dutch East Indies. And it was during this period that we got our second LCM, the landing craft, the boat. And this one was 56 foot long. The original one was 50. And we had titled our first boat Lucky Lady. So this was Lucky Lady number two, Roman numeral two. So the first one lasted 240 days, approximately 8 months, and it ran about 820 hours. I kept track in my logbook of the hours that we ran each day, and the amount of fuel used. We had 2 450-gallon tanks on the boat, and by the way, we had two gray marine twin diesel engines. They were strictly diesel in the landing craft because of the safety factor. And let's see, where was I going with that?
Were you protected during all that time, or were you ever under attack, or were you
during that,
was that
period,
a safe
no,
place
that,
to
that
be?
We were those places were all relatively safe. Yeah, we hadn't we were not under attack at any point during that those that first year or so. There was always the threat, but actually no. Then on February 2nd, 1945. Our boat was loaded aboard a personnel attack carrier, the U.S. Biddle, B-I-D-D-L-E, and we were lashed to the deck with three other boats of our, three other LCMs. And we went from Biak to Leyte in the Philippine Islands, which was the scene of a huge naval battle and lots of action there before we got there. Then we left Leyte and went to an island called Mindoro, and I have a note here that we hired a Filipino boy at one point there that we were to do odd jobs, which apparently, all the boat companies did it. You know, they had them wash the decks and do whatever odd jobs we didn't want to do. And we paid them 30 pesos a month, and they were there for a couple of months, something like that. But then in March of 45, we loaded aboard a 32-ton Sherman medium tank and a five-man crew. And we drove aboard an LSD, a landing ship dock, which is a boat that goes down in the water and you drive your boat into it. And that's for longer, where we're going on a long distance. And there were 14 other LCMs on this dock, this LSD, so you can imagine the size of it. We were heading for a town called Zamboanga. This was our first combat. It was J-Day. And the this was on the southernmost island of the Philippines, Mindanao. And during the war, they had a song about Zamboanga. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it, but it was called "The Monkeys Have No Tails in Zamboanga." Oh, the monkeys have no tails in Zamboanga. So that was a fun song. But on that day, March 10th, 45, it's kind of like you see in the movies where the ocean was full of our craft. There were a lot of LCMs, a lot of destroyers, cruisers, every kind of a ship you could. We didn't have any battleships there, or the heavy cruisers, but we had light cruisers all the way down. And the Air Force came in first. It was a beautiful sunny day. I remember the palm trees were waving in the breeze. And the Air Force came in first and dropped their loads, one after the other, as I put in my logbook, the shoreline was a mass of smoke and flame, and then the naval bombardment started. The destroyers and the cruisers cut loose with their all of their stuff, and then finally some of the smaller ships went right up to the shore with rockets and the whole place. I mean, we had a young lieutenant on our boat who said, "Ho ho, unopposed landing," and we all could have killed him because we know that they dig in and they're in caves and underground and all of that. So we were not happy with that comment, but. Anyway, we hit the beach about 9:15 a.m. The boat went into shore. The coxswain, a guy named Hollis P. Loudermilk, he was from Cornelia, Georgia, dropped the ramp, the tank, and it was, he did a great job of getting it far enough on the beach so the tank could go on the beach and not sink down in the water. Off they went, and then we reversed engines and backed out and went out to way out through 3-4 miles from shore to our rendezvous point. And then we were told that later that 2,900 Japs had died in that operation and about 130 of our guys. During that time, we were, the landing was on the 10th. On the 14th, all of the men were called off the boats, except one to stay with the boat, because we had heard that there was going to be a counterattack by the Japs, and they wanted every man possible to be there for that, to support the ground troops. I wound up in a shell hole from the bombardment, and one of my buddies was a few feet away, and they were spread all over the place. And we went in there at dusk. It was a long night, one of the longest nights of my life. You imagined all kinds of things. You could see the palm trees waving in the breeze, you wondered, is that somebody or whatever? And of course, we were told, don't shoot unless you're sure. So And we had our helmets on, and along about 4, 5, 6 hours later, you begin to nod. And then when your neck drops and with the helmet on it, oh, that's a jolt. So, but as it turned out, there was no counterattack, and we were never so glad to see the sun come up as on that date. But I did forget one other incident earlier on going back to New Guinea for a minute. We got caught in a hurricane going up the coast of New Guinea, and the conditions were such that we weren't at a point where we could get into a bay or a harbor, so we had to ride it out. And there was a convoy of about 14 landing craft like ours, and and it was at night. It started, the water started getting rough towards dusk, and we were just simply caught and had to ride it out. But I got up on deck and looked, and if you've ever seen a wave that's about 20, 30 feet high coming at you, and then your boat is going down into the trough, and when it hits the trough, bang, it hits the bottom of the trough, and then it starts going up again, and the wave is going over, and it's a very terrifying thing to look at. And that was maybe the second longest night of my life, because that storm didn't abate until mid-morning. So even in the daylight, it was still pretty strong. But the coxswain had to be, he was the real guy who was in charge, and he was guiding the boat. And there was the command boat had a searchlight, a search beam, and he would periodically indicate that we should get closer, because they didn't want any boats drifting off to where we wouldn't be able to find them. So, and we had, I think there were 5 or 6 on the boat at that time, and we were all down in the well area. And we couldn't do anything but talk, and I was so tired because we had worked hard that day that I was lucky enough to fall asleep for a while. So I was kind of out of it. And there was an older guy from Chicago. He was 36 years old. That's an older guy in the service. And he was just, boy, I don't know. And when we got back to safety, he said he had to get out of this outfit. He would never make a sailor. So let's see. There was... something else I meant to mention was the fact that we lived on those boats, and we had to build our own facilities. We had to build a cabin. When we first started out, we had cots in the well of the boat, and we would throw a canvas over us or a raincoat if it started raining. But then, as the time went by, we got some lumber from these packing cases that were bringing our boat parts overseas, and we would build a floor or a deck, and it wasn't very long. It was about 6-7 feet out over the well deck, and then it was a flat flooring, and then there were two cots, an upper and a lower, on each side of that platform. And then we built a roof over that with a canvas covering, and we had, of course, an opening where we could go inside, and if it was raining heavily, which it frequently did, we were there during the rainy season, so we were able to get a lot more comfortable by being in the cabin. And of course, as I think I mentioned, the temperature there was always very season, very, you know, 80 degrees, 90 degrees. It was very warm weather, so being cold was never a factor.
Did you cook there yourselves, or did you have cave rations?
Well, we initially we had strictly the C rations, K rations. They had something called 10-in-1 rations, where there were little little crackers and cans of beef stew, that sort of thing. I got to hate beef stew. But later on we got a little Coleman stove where you could pump and heat things up. But for the most part, we did no cooking on board. But periodically we went to shore when we were going to be for a more or less an extended period. And then we were in tents. They were able to set up a kitchen and serve more normal food from time to time. So. Well, let's see. I got a letter from my brother on March of 45, and he was safe after the Iwo Jima invasion. On April 12th, 45, we got news that President Roosevelt had died, that Harry Truman took over, and I put a note in my journal that I was 19 years old, and I said, I guess FDR will probably go down as one of our greatest presidents. And let's see. On May 8th, we got news that Germany had surrendered, and that was a big day. May 9th was VE Day, Victory in Europe.
How did you find out all those things?
Well, in the early part of our tour over there, we didn't know anything. We for weeks at a time we wouldn't hear anything. And then, as we stopped in these various towns and places, then we would get word that we finally got a little radio, and that was the greatest thing that we could have gotten. So we could hear news reports and that sort of thing. So yeah. Let's see, where did we go from there? Oh, yeah, then on June 15th of 45, I got in an airplane for the first time in my life, a C-47 with 20 other men, and we went to a place called Moratai in the Malacca Islands to work with Australia's a group of Australians that was their famous 9th Division. They were well known for victories and good work overseas there. And they were preparing for the invasion of Borneo, which was Japanese held at that time. And when we arrived there, we did finally get an attack of the Japanese Zeros. They bombed the airport. But it was a one-shot thing, and that reminds me too. When we were in Zamboanga, there was an airplane, a Zero, that flew over the dock on that same day that we were thinking about the counterattack, and he was low enough and close enough so I could see him in the cockpit going over. Now, some of the guys said he was strafing, and I didn't remember. I think that was an embellishment, because I think he was a reconnaissance plane that was checking out our situation there. After the Zamboanga landing, we made two other landings on islands around, places around there, one called Basilan and one called Jolo, and they were fairly minor. The brochure that we have down here shows that our brigade had 60 combat landings. Now, I was only in three of them, and these others were all at different places and by the different brigades. There were four engineer special brigades. One of them went to Africa, and the other three mostly were in the South Pacific. So, okay, then on August 10th of 45, we got a newsflash that Japan had surrendered. I do have a letter in this book here that I wrote to the folks about that day, and I'd like to read the first part of it, but just to set the picture, we were at a movie out in the jungles under the palm trees. We're sitting on logs, and the movie was interrupted by the projectionist, and he announced that Japan had surrendered. And
did you know about the atomic bomb being dropped?
Yes, we had heard that. A few days before, a couple of days before, we had heard that the bombs had been dropped. So we knew that something big was happening. And so they stopped the movie. He announced that the war was over, and there was nothing said for a minute or two. Everybody was shell-shocked, I guess. And then they turned the movie back on, and he shouldn't have, because nobody wanted to see the movie anymore. And that was when they came around and collected all the arms, the rifles, anything that had a bullet in it. And then they passed out six cans of 3.2 beer to every soldier, and they were whooping it up. I tell you. And I've got a picture in this life book here of the boats in the harbor, Lady Harbor. Did I say Zambia? This was at Lady. And they shot off pyrotechnics of every kind. I mean, it was just a giant fireworks display. And horns were honking, and it was just a heck of an occasion. So, would it be possible for me to... Can you reach that book that I could read part of that letter?
Okay.
All set? This was on Sunday, August 12th, 1945. Dear folks, I'm sorry I haven't written for the past 2 days, but I've been too busy trying to figure out whether the war is over or not. I've had my ear glued to the radio all day today and yesterday, and I only hope now that Japan accepts the United States peace offer. The radio announcer just said that the programs to follow will be interrupted if any late bulletins come in, so they must be expecting the end soon. The night before last, I was sitting at the show when the movie operator cut off the sound and said, "The news just came over the radio that the war is over." Nobody could say a thing for about a full minute, and then they cut loose with such cheering and yelling like I never heard before. The operator turned on the movie again, but nobody was interested in that anymore, and the truck took us back to camp. They issued six extra cans of beer to every man and ordered all rifles turned in to the supply room so no one would get hurt. No one would get too excited and start shooting them off. Everybody sat around in the tents drinking beer, singing like nobody's business, and kidding about getting their equipment packed and ready to leave for the States in the morning. That kept on till about 2 a.m., and you never saw such a bunch of happy guys. Out in the harbor, ships were shooting off red flares, automobile horns were blowing, and it seemed like the whole island was yelling and cheering. That's one night I'll never forget. Boy, I'll bet the people back in the States really raised hell when they heard about Japan offering to surrender. Well, it can't be more than another day or so before all fighting and bombing stops. Just think what a wonderful day that will be, when no more people are getting killed and the whole world will be at peace again. The letters that I sent to my folks, they kept every one of them. And So over a 2.5 year period, that's a lot of letters. And they kept them in the original envelopes and with the stamps and everything else. And then I inherited that when my folks died. I got all those letters. And many, many years later, I decided to put them in order. So I put them in chronological order by date and took them out of the envelopes. And then just a year or two ago, I converted them to the computer. So every letter that I had written home, I converted to the computer, and then those were I put on software. I got two software floppy disks, and so they're preserved, and I have one in my safety deposit box, and then of course I have the computer in memory. So the letters are still in amazingly good. I mean, this is 65 years ago, and the letters are still very readable. They're yellowing and aging, but it's amazing how well preserved they are. So I've got both the original letters and the computerized ones.
Thinking back about it, when you read the letters, did you sound like you were 18?
Yeah,
all the way through.
Yeah.
Or
well, I guess I matured a little bit, but when you think about when I was discharged, I was still only 20 years old. I was short of my my 21st birthday, so I couldn't get a beer in a bar. I had to, you know, check my. Well, I wasn't a drinker anyway, but but I was less than 21 when I got out. So then, while we were at Leyte, and the big news came through. We were actually preparing for the invasion of Japan. And
what would your role have been there?
The same. We would have been delivering troops on the beaches and supplies. It was called the greatest battle that was never fought, because in the projections that they made about the number of people that would have died had they had to land on Japanese soil, it would have been just terrible. There are numbers somewhere. I think they're in the millions. But then the two atomic bombs took care of that, and Harry Truman, who was pretty much maligned as a successor to FDR. He was a rookie and you didn't know what he could do and all that, but then later on he became recognized as a pretty good president making big decisions.
What rank were you by this point?
I was still a T5 at that point, and we actually did go to Japan on September 18th of 45, we left Leyte in a convoy of, I don't have the number down there, but it was our whole outfit, and we got hauled aboard an AKA, the U.S. Southampton, and 7 days later, we arrived on the northern tip of Honshu, in Japan, a town called Aomori, A-O-M-O-R-I. They had a population of about 100,000, and they were about 400 miles from Tokyo. And we moved ashore to barracks, and then we hit the cold weather, which we weren't used to for 2 years in the balmy South Pacific. And there they had stoves, and we had to get cold weather gear, warmer coats and underwear and the whole bit. And then we We took our lucky lady number two and drove it up to the final resting place. And in that month, in the month of October of 45, we were all issued a souvenir Japanese rifle and bayonet. And you know, I don't know what happened to that thing, but I had it for a long time, and I let somebody borrow it, and then somewhere it got lost in transit, I guess. But oh, here's when I was made Tech 4. November 1st of 45. That was just about 2 months before I was discharged, so I only got the extra pay for a couple of months. But then, there was one incident in Japan that I got to tell you about. I was assigned as a corporal of the guard one day to drive the soldiers to their posts in a jeep, and I didn't want to tell them that I couldn't drive. I'd never driven in my life. So, but I had a day or two before I had to do it. So I was talking to my buddies, and how do you do this anyway? Oh, I just think of the letter H. You know, the center thing is neutral and up in the left. And so they told me all about the gears and all that. So there we go for the guard duty, and I'm I was pretty bad at first, but it didn't take me too long to get the hang of it. Somehow I got them there and back. So then on December, I'm not sure of the date, 45, we left Amori by train for the separation center in Yokohama. And they were assigned by the point system. You went home earlier if you had the higher number of points, and it was based on your age, whether you were married, whether you had kids, your length of service, your number of months overseas. All of those were taken into consideration, and I was kind of at the lower point because I was only 19. By that time I was 20, but no other points that would help me along those lines. But anyway, I finally left Amori early December, or Yokohama. That was the point of embarkation, and then we arrived in Vancouver Barracks in Seattle on December 19th of 45, hoping we would get home for Christmas. But that didn't work out, so we left Seattle for Camp Grant, Rockford, where I started out in the very first place. And my discharge was on January 2nd, 1946. So when I got to when I got my discharge, I went to downtown Chicago, bought a train ticket to get home, called my folks and said, I'm here. And my brother was there, and he said, I'll come and pick you up. And I said, I've got a train ticket. He said, that's all right, I'll come to get you. So he came in his, what do you have, a 35 Dodge Coupe, and he picked me up, and I said, wow, I said, I never thought I'd get home again. He says, why? There's a guy who was in Iwo Jima, and so, but I still got that train ticket in my files, that, the unused train ticket. Let's see, I probably have left out some things, but after I was discharged, I was able to take advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and go on to... I finished my second year at the community college, Wilson Junior College, and then I went on to the University of Chicago and got my MBA degree. Thank you, Uncle Sam. And then, let's see, I went to work. My first job was as a junior cost accountant on the south side of Chicago at the grand salary of $200 a month with an MBA degree. Things were mighty tough in 1949 when I got that first job. So, but then after that, I stayed with that company for the rest of my life. I was there 39 years and worked my way up to the corporate treasurer's job. And then, let's see, that's kind of a nutshell history of my life. I got married and had three kids after I was out, and my first wife died of breast cancer in 1989, and I met Myrna in 1992, and we've been married for 16 years now. So
you started out in Rockford, you came back to Rockford.
Yep.
If you had to sum up the period of time in between, can you do it in just a sentence or two?
Wow. Well, it was 2.5 years out of my young life. I was foreign-born, but I fought for my country. The United States is the greatest country in the world. And my mother always said, Vicum til America o ficte bra. She said, we came to the America and had it good. So now she was a little leery when Pearl Harbor happened, because she knew that what was going to happen. And her first words were, oh, nu blir det krig. Now there will be war. And she knew that her two sons were going to be involved, and they were. But they came out okay. And now my older brother died at the age of 81 about 2 years ago. And but he had a good life too. And so
it was worth it.
It was definitely worth it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I retired early, he retired, and